This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back to the third hour of our program. In the first hour, Senator Sanders dropped by and proclaimed his candidacy for president. I mean, he had done that before, but, you know, talked about exactly where we're going from here, and to paraphrase the title of his book. And we've been talking about, you know, and we played in our second hour a whole bunch of FDR clips, because basically what I'm seeing right now is the Democratic Party returning to its roots, returning to the core of the modern day Democratic Party, the last century of the Democratic Party, which was established by FDR and was expanded and built by LBJ, setting aside the Vietnam War. And now it's time to go the next step. Right. And, you know, whether it's Bernie or whoever it may be, we've got some great progressive candidates there. But Bernie, 4 or 5 years ago, created a space for a conversation. 4 or 5 years ago, when Bernie first introduced Medicare for All in the United States Senate, not one senator co-sponsored it. Not one Democrat would join him. Now they're falling all over themselves. I mean, that's just, you know, one example of many, you know, the $15 minimum wage, the Green New Deal, breaking up the Wall Street banks, free tuition of public colleges, paid family and medical leave, gender pay equity, stopping corporate money in elections, you know, new labor laws to encourage union membership, expanding Social Security, legalizing pot, ending cash bail, you know, et cetera. I mean, there's some serious stuff there. And as Robert Reich said in a piece in The Guardian this morning, in which he was not endorsing Bernie, he was simply saying, and I agree with the sentiment, he said, Sanders has done more than any other politician in modern America to sound the alarm and mobilize the public to reclaim our democracy and our economy. And I agree with Robert Reich in that regard. You know, whether Bernie's the nominee or not, it's going to be a great time. So that said, There are a few other issues here that I wanted to get into with you as well. There's a piece in the New York Times today titled Time to Panic. The planet is warming. It's by David Wallace Wells. He's got a new book out called The Uninhabitable Earth, Life After Warming. And the subtitle is The Planet is Getting Warmer in Catastrophic Ways, and Fear May Be the Only Thing That Saves Us. You know, climate change is actually a real emergency, not a phony baloney one like Trump's wall. The planet has already warmed 1 degree. 2 degrees could be a civilization-ending event. It could throw us back to the Stone Age. Right now, that 1 degree of warming is killing people all over the world and is getting worse far faster than anybody except the real doomsayers were projecting. The worst case expectations. Every 5 years, the IPCC does a report. And every year, they offer best case, probable case, and worst case scenarios. And every year, every 5 years, when we look back at the last report from 5 years previously, what has happened has been worse than the worst case scenario. I'm pretty sure without exception. We're going to have Michael Mann on in a couple of days, day after tomorrow, to talk a little more about this. But this is literally killing people. I mean, Americans are dying, whether it's in wildfires in California or mile-wide tornadoes in Oklahoma or hurricanes in Puerto Rico and in Florida or in the Gulf of Mexico. Americans literally are dying. People around the world are dying. Climate refugees are a thing now. It's real. The whole mess in the Middle East, the so-called Arab Spring, wasn't, you know, some wonderful hope for democracy. It was kicked off by a massive increase in the price of bread in Tunisia. And the street vendor lit himself on fire, but it wasn't just him. It was everybody was really upset. Why was the price of bread so high? And bread is a staple food in that area, right? Why had that price gone up? It had gone up because the desert had moved 100 miles south and wiped out hundreds of millions of acres of farmland. And so the price of food went up. As the price of food went up, all these countries across northern Africa became destabilized. And people died. Literally millions of people have died now as a result of climate change. And the United States has spent, you know, according to Donald Trump, $7 trillion, according to the Pentagon, $5.6 trillion on stupid and unnecessary wars in that region, responding to conflicts that in many cases started with climate change. And meanwhile, we got fossil fuel billionaires and their companies accumulating money faster than we ever thought possible. And they're spending, you know, they're literally making billions, and they're spending millions to buy politicians and to buy public opinion. When the Washington State, just north of me here, tried to pass a carbon tax last year, it was on the November ballot. They had this old Republican Secretary of State who looks like Mr. Rogers. What a nice guy. He talks real nice. Never mentioned he was a Republican, never once. And said, oh, this giant tax, it's open-ended. These panels are going to spend the money, and they're not going to tell you how. These essentially lies from the fossil fuel industry. Fear-mongering. Incomplete data at the very best. And they spent a few million bucks here and there doing these kind of things, these kind of lies on TV. People voted down the carbon tax so they can continue making their profits and continue destroying the earth. We have to deal with climate change as if it was a moral crime. We have to strip any vestige of respectability from any politician who denies climate change is happening. We have to strip all of the subsidies from the fossil fuel industry. We're supporting this industry to the tune of hundreds of billions of dollars a year just in the United States, trillions of dollars a year worldwide. We're supporting this industry that is killing the planet and us. And we need to immediately tax carbon while rolling out a new Green New Deal. I think it is time to panic. I agreed with David Wallace Wells. His point is that in cancer research, when they discover that, for example, the nitrosamines that are formed in processed luncheon meats cause cancer, and if you eat, you know, processed luncheon meats, you're more likely to have cancer, they don't roll that information out and say, but there are some people who disagree, and we're not really sure how bad it is. No, they just say, here's the science. Climate change is the only area where everybody's been hedging their rhetoric. Why? Because they're afraid of the money of this industry, of these industries. And now, this is incredible. This is from the Financial Times this morning. Janet Yellen, the last chair of the Federal Reserve, right, one of the smartest economists in the world, and, you know, prior to leaving her position, one of the most powerful, and morally still one of the most powerful. Janet Yellen and all four still living former chairs of the Federal Reserve. That is five people, setting aside the guy who's running it right now. We don't know what his position is. But Janet Yellen and the four Fed chairs before her who are still alive. These are people who were chairwoman, all the rest of them were men. Chairman of the Fed going all the way back to the Carter administration, maybe to Jerry Ford. All of them explicitly and publicly support a carbon tax right now. To save the world and to save the economy, all of them. And 30 Nobel Prize economists, and all but one of the former chairs of the White House, again, going back to Carter, Ford, Reagan, God only knows how long they're still alive. But if you look at the White House Council of Economic Advisors, with only one exception, every single former chair of the White House Council of Economic Advisors supports a carbon tax right now. Janet Yellen said we would impose a tax on goods entering the country from localities with less ambitious climate change policies or lower carbon taxes. Not or lower them, but from places that have lower carbon taxes. So this would offset the environmental loss that would come from shifting production to places that generate more greenhouse gas emissions. It would also level the playing field competitively, and we think that a set of border tax adjustments would also encourage other countries to come into compliance and join the club of countries imposing carbon taxes. This is just like simple, simple stuff. I mean, this is not super complex. It's sort of like, you know, earlier I was saying, you know, we know from the experience of the GI Bill back in the 1950s and 60s that for every dollar you invest in educating somebody, every federal dollar, tax dollar that you spend educating somebody at the college level, you make back $7 over their lifetime that you wouldn't have had otherwise in tax income because they have higher income. Free college pays for itself. We know The Medicare for All pays for itself. It cuts 20% off the top of all of our expenses. How can it not pay for itself? Or not necessarily pay for itself, but save us money. Save us, you know, as much as $1 trillion a year. I mean, these are not complex things. And when it comes to climate change, taxing carbon, I mean, you want to move to a carbon-free economy? I mean, Luke Vargas was just telling us in the last hour how, you know, the Trump administration, presumably because the Trumps and the Kushners are taking money from the Saudis or the Emiratis or something, there's some stinky deal going on here. They're trying to, or they're taking money from the nuclear industry. They're trying to build nuclear plants in Saudi Arabia. Well, why do countries want nuclear plants? Either A, they have an electricity shortage, or B, they want to make nuclear weapons. Because you run the nuclear plants, and the waste product of the nuclear plants is the stuff that you use to make weapons. Now, Saudi Arabia, of all places on Earth, does not have a shortage of sunlight. I mean, they've got nuclear power up the wazoo, right? There's 93 million miles away, there's a nuclear fusion reactor we call the sun. And it's pouring down on Saudi Arabia all day, every day. The last country on Earth that needs to turn to nuclear power for electricity is Saudi Arabia. So what's going on here? Looks to me like they want to make nuclear weapons. And why is Trump trying to facilitate this and Jared Kushner? Well, both of their companies were broke. They got a whole bunch of money from somewhere. What the hell's going on with this? So, you know, let's wake up to this stuff. Let's pay attention to this. Let's be smart. Let's put together a carbon tax, and let's actually, yes, say it is time to panic. We do have a crisis on our hands, and it's not on our southern border. It has to do with the amount of carbon dioxide and methane that is in our atmosphere, along with a few other chemicals that are greenhouse gas chemicals. And we have to do something about this. If we fail to do something about this, our children, our grandchildren, and we ourselves, those of us who are, you know, young enough to plan on still being alive in 30, 40 years, may well be in living in a world in which we literally do not have what we call civilization right now. This is an existential emergency. We do need to respond to it. And we need to make sure that it plays a prominent role in the politics as we lead into this presidential election.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
18 minutes past the hour. We'll pick up your phone calls after the break. And welcome back, Laura in Champaign, Illinois. Hey, Laura, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call. There is something that concerns me. There's a lot of talk about Bernie being too old. And I think this is wrong. We should not make Bernie a victim of ageism. We need to look at people as individuals. There really are many older men and women in their 80s who are intelligently brighter and more energetic and wiser than younger people.
Yep.
And Bernie would bring a tremendous amount of experience, intelligence, foresight and wisdom to the office of the presidency, and is very capable of being leader of our nation. If you remember the enormous crowds that Bernie was able to attract when he was in the race running for president, Bernie can win with, I believe, a younger female vice president like Warren or Harris. So I don't think he should be dismissed because he will be 79 years old. I think that he is just very capable. And let's not make him a victim of ageism.
Yeah, I agree with you. The only concern that I have with regard to his age is that he has somebody as vice president. Because, you know, we do get disabled and we do die, you know, at some point. It happens to all of us. It will happen to all of us. You know, God forbid, but we have to acknowledge that, that he has somebody as a vice president who shares his values and can pick up and run forward if anything, God forbid, should happen to him. But, you know, I'm with you. I'm absolutely with you. Thank you, Laura, for the call. Very well said. Jerry in Rochester, Washington. Hey, Jerry, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Listen, I'm pushing 74, so I was there at the beginning listening to Bernie Sanders. I didn't know much about him until about 6 years ago. But the number one thing I'm going to say, to play these games, we have to keep the playground healthy, which this climate catastrophe we're in now is number one. We can't play the game either evil or good unless we have a playground to play it in. And Bernie's always been there in the forefront before all these other people, these Dems came on, of health, education, and welfare for the American people. And there's one thing I wanted to ask you for a long time, and if you think this still plays a role in world politics. In 1981, Maxwell Taylor said that the underlying cause of world problem was overpopulation. He said it'd be necessary by the beginning of the 21st century to reduce the human population, mostly in third world countries, by disease, starvation, regional conflicts. Boy, that looks like what's been going on for 50 years here almost, you know.
Yeah.
So do you think that still plays a big role here? And if it does, that needs to be tackled quick, because the new saying or the new word we should all learn is we're all being victims of elitism.
Yeah, of the economic royalists, as FDR called them. Jerry, thank you for the call. Yeah, population is a major issue. I'm not a fan of rapid population reduction at all. If the population of the world would simply eat a lot less meat, for example, as a starting point, we could go a lot farther. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and Nicholas in San Cristobal, Mexico. Hey, Nicholas, what's up?
Wow, so many things are up, and what a great day, huh?
Indeed.
Wow, Bernie, it just said, does this old hurt a lot of good to see another old guy knocking it out of the ballpark? Quickly, I wanted to tell you something about the AMLO campaign down here.
Sure.
You know, is for your listeners who don't know, really quite a massive progressive who really swept the entire Mexican election, much to a tremendous number of people's surprise. One way he did it was to broaden the conversation and make it something other than just him running against the competition. As you know, and as I think you and I have discussed before the election, he announced his entire potential cabinet, much of which was actually installed. He was right in the picks. The point being, if you were to say to all the Ocasio-Cortez voters, I will choose her for housing and urban development or some other position, you get the point. Quickly, the conversation becomes something more than about Bernie, for example, or about AMLO in the case that I'm talking about. And it took everybody by surprise, and suddenly the conversation was about much more than AMLO. It was about how to save the country. And he swept the election, as you know.
That's fascinating. Yeah, and I don't think most Americans realize that basically the new president of Mexico is the Mexican version of Bernie Sanders.
It's the strangest thing, isn't it? It just all got turned on its head. You would not expect that from Mexico, and you would not expect Donald Trump from the United States, but there we are.
And not only that, he's doing well.
He's still got 86% approval rating.
That's incredible.
86%, much higher than when he won.
Yeah. Nicholas, thanks for the call. While I have you on the line, what is the sense nowadays in Mexico? I mean, obviously hostility toward Trump around the wall and that kind of stuff, but other issues where America could be leading and instead we're screwing up, like climate change, social justice, things like this.
General perception?
I'm sorry?
Are you asking what the general perception of Mexico is?
Yes. What is the Mexican perception of American politics beyond just the
wall? I talk to a lot of people and to a lot of groups down here. It sounds so awful. They're embarrassed for us.
Yeah.
And they say it out loud. They're ashamed and embarrassed for us. They expected more. And yet now they are the ones leading.
You know, I lived in Germany in 86 and 87. And yeah. Reagan was president, and I had more than one German say, I'm so sorry for you. that you have to have that man as your president.
I hear it all the time, and it hurts me so always say, you know, I know and I thank you, but yeah, we're sorry for ourselves.
Yeah, amen. Nicholas, thanks for the call. It's great to hear from you, and thanks for watching us on YouTube.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-808-9925.
And in fact, Nicholas, thanks for moderating our chat room on YouTube as well. We'll be right back. It's coming up on the bottom of the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And let's see here. David in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Hey, David, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. Thank you for taking my call. So I just wanted to go back to the Medicare for All. The only reason why I would be very opposed against it is just because if you look at the conditions with what people do as far as eating and everything else, they go to excess. And part of it is we do have a huge obesity problem. And in addition to that, we also have, there's other vices with, you know, alcoholism and, you know, people doing cigarettes and everything else. So you do have that parameter, whereas if you look at smaller countries like the Netherlands, they don't have that kind of disproportionate amount of people that are obese and that are doing other things.
Might that have something to do, David, with the fact that they have a national health care system, and therefore much of the activity of the government and certainly social pressures are toward healthy lifestyles, rather than all we have here in the United States is companies selling unhealthy products? You know, I was in the UK last week, and we were at this conference. They were giving out Coke, you know, cans of Coke. I looked on the can, and it was sugar instead of high fructose corn syrup. We know that high fructose corn syrup causes fatty liver disease. It contributes to obesity and diabetes. I mean, we're being poisoned by our own food supply, and nobody's pushing back because there's no money to be made in pushing back.
Well, and I think that that's the narrative that I would look at, is to try to get people more conscientious about what they're eating, because if they don't change the eating habits, it's not going to cure the health system that we have here, because that's the underlying problem.
Right. And it's not entirely what people eat. I mean, there's a whole bunch of other variables, but you know, that's a piece of it. But yes, and governments in countries that have national health care systems encourage, they educate children in school about healthy eating. And it's not like here in the United States where the dairy industry goes in and spiffs a bunch of people in the U.S. Department of Agriculture, or even gets their people in the USDA, and then they come up with a food pyramid that's like, oh, you must have cheese every day, you know, which is just basically cow mucus.
Hey, you're talking about Wisconsin now.
Yeah, okay, sorry. David, I got to move along, but thank you for the call. I get your point. It's a good one. From David to David in Canterbury, Connecticut. Hey, David, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, a longtime socialist, occasional caller.
Thank you.
Very, very excited about Bernie getting in the race. What's happening already, Tom, on the first day is the African-American conservative class is dismissing Bernie already as not being tuned in enough to the African-American political existence and problems. And you tie that in, you were talking about FDR today, and I said, oh, my God, I was thinking about that when I called, and you came on with the FDR stuff. I love it. I love FDR, but if you tie this to what I originally just said when I came on, back to the history of FDR, and people are getting hip to this, Tom, that while he did win big in big elections, a lot of black folks didn't vote or couldn't vote. And some of the reasons they didn't vote, Tom, is because they didn't get in the Social Security system. 80% of the blacks in Alabama were not in the Social Security system. Farmers.
There were no racial restrictions on that. You know, in fact, in June of 1941, Franklin Roosevelt signed Executive Order 8802, which created the Fair Employment Practices Committee. It was the first time in federal law that, you know, it said, the order stated that the federal government could not hire any person based on race, color, creed, or national origin. Millions of African Americans and women achieved better jobs as a result. If you look at what he did, what he actually did, did. By 1935, and this is from the Roosevelt Institute, by 1935, the WPA, the Works Progress Administration, was employing 350,000 African Americans annually, 15% of its total workforce. The Civilian Conservation Corps, the percentage of blacks, started at 3% in 1933. It was 11% by 1938, by the time, it wrapped up in 1942. 350,000 African Americans working for the CCC. The National Youth Administration, FDR hired more black administrators than any other New Deal agency. Black administrators did not even exist in the political power structures of the United States prior to the FDR presidency. He had more than 300,000 African-American youth who were served by that agency. In 1934, the WPA inserted a clause in all government construction contracts establishing a quota for the hiring of black laborers based on the 1930 census. So the government every contractor had to have a percentage of African Americans working for them that was equal to the percentage of African Americans in the population. And as a consequence of that, this began a black middle class. I mean, it was, yes, we were still, this was before Brown versus Board. We were still a segregated society. He was the first president to appoint an African American as a federal judge. He was the first to promote a black man to the rank of brigadier general in the army, and he was called a traitor for this. He was the first president, honest to God, the first president in the history of the United States to refer to lynching as murder. He called it, quote, that vile form of collective murder. Was mercilessly attacked by Republicans for that. W.E.B. Du Bois said, this is, quote, this is something that is sadly long overdue. And in the 1936 convention, when Franklin Roosevelt was running for re-election the first time, at his insistence, and Eleanor actually gets a lot of credit for this, but at his personal insistence, it was the first time a specific African-American plank was inserted into a party platform, 1936 FDR. So, there was a lot wrong with race relations in the United States in the 1930s and 40s. But, FDR was not, race was not invisible to him.
Tom, can I say something?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm talking about Social Security. I'm talking about the FHA. I'm talking about later on down the line, for the veterans, the GI Bill.
Oh, yeah, black people got screwed by all those things. I totally agree, David. But what does that have to do with on the one hand, FDR,
the extent he could. I agree with all that stuff that you're saying about FDR. But there were problems. And black intellectuals today, Ta-Nehisi Coates, I've been reading Ta-Nehisi Coates. He's been bringing this out. And people are going to start reading it, Tom.
Yeah.
All I'm saying is that Bernie needs to not make those same... it wasn't a mistake for FDR because... black people didn't vote en masse.
David, we'll just see how it's going to shake out. I just want the record to be at least semi-straight here. Michael in St. Louis, Missouri. Hey, Michael, what's on your mind today?
Yes, hi, Tom. There's a new approach to Medicare for All that I learned about Sunday. Rosa DeLauro of Connecticut and Jan Jankowski of Illinois have a bill named the Medicare for America Act of 2018. I learned about this Sunday on Huffington Post in an article titled, Two Liberal Democrats Are Promoting a Twist on Medicare for All. In it, it would create a comprehensive government-run insurance program that would replace all insurance run by the government and private employers, private insurance companies.
Well, that's Medicare for All.
Medicare for America.
Who are the authors of this?
Rosa DeLauro of Connecticut and Jan Jankowski of
Illinois. Oh, so this is coming out of the House. So this is probably the House's version of Bernie's Medicare for All in the Senate.
I don't know. I can't.
Yeah, I know that they're trying to get them very, very close to each other so that they, so when they go to conference committee, they can clean it up really quickly. If it ever gets to conference committee. I mean, that assumes that Mitch McConnell allows a vote, which ain't going to happen.
But the big difference here is that they're proposing it's a government-run comprehensive plan that would allow large insurance companies to continue to offer to their employees the private insurance. They believe, Rosa and Jan believe, that It would be more palatable to those 160 million who have that insurance that they could opt out of Medicare for America plan and continue with their company-provided insurance plan, with the idea that over time, these employees would see that the Medicare for America plan is more beneficial and more cost.
Well, that was the idea of the public option. When, you know, if it wasn't for Joe Lieberman, we would have had a public option in Obamacare. And if we had a public option, people could say, okay, you know, I'll buy this insurance policy from Aetna, or I'll buy the, you know, the Medicare as the public option. And obviously, Medicare doesn't carry that 20 to 25% profit overhead that these so-called health insurance company banksters do. So, you know, yeah. Michael, thanks for the tip on that. Joe in Tucson, Arizona. Hey, Joe, what's up?
Tom, I just want you to know, I'll start off, you guys are the best.
Thank
that's
you.
First. And
it's a team effort here.
So David Pakman, he had a great little clip on his site, and it was how liberals can pay for all this free stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just six things, and he had a bunch more on there. And but man, this topic is going to be heavy coming up here, because it's on right now. But
yep.
Reversing the Bush tax cuts, well, first of all, how he defined it was we need to come up with $1.4 trillion and a little bit of change. And so $1.2 trillion for Medicare is what we need. Tuition-free, he's got it billed out at $80 billion a year. Paid family leave, maternal and paternal, that's $32 billion a year. Social Security expansion.
Joe, you know, when you start reading lists like this, people's eyes just glaze over.
Oh, okay.
And I realize I'm guilty of the same thing just a few minutes ago, but to the point.
Reverse the Bush tax cuts, reverse the Trump tax cuts, stop the wars, carbon tax at $73 a ton.
Yeah, and bring back the STET tax, the securities transaction excise tax, the tax
He's
on Wall Street.
He's got all that on there, Tom. He's got a whole bunch.
Oh, I know. I'm familiar with it. It's not unique to David. It's you know, a whole, and who's a great guy and does a great show. But there are a bunch of great economists who have been laying this stuff out for some time. And you're absolutely right, Joe. It's easy to pay for these things. And not only that, over time, they pay back more money than they cost. You know, the only things that don't are tax cuts and war, which is, you know, what the Republicans are all about, right? They have two things, the Republicans. Well, three. Tax cuts, war, and subsidies for the fossil fuel industry. None of those things grow the American economy. None of those things help our country. I think the Democrats are in a pretty good position right now. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Back with more of your calls in just a moment. Stick around. Oh, welcome back. Jeff in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Jeff, what's on your mind today? Thanks for listening to X-Ray FM.
Hey, thank you, Tom. Good morning, and great show as usual, and thanks for taking my call. With Bernie announcing his candidacy, I believe it's a great day in our struggle to restore democracy to America. And that Robert Reich piece you mentioned in today's Guardian, it's titled, "Can Bernie Sanders Repeat His Surprising Success This Time Around?" And Professor Reich makes the obvious, but I think well worth repeating, point that Trump was, quote, a Trojan horse for the same oligarchy he condemned, unquote.
Correct.
Bernie, on the other hand, Tom, as we here in your community all knew and many others now know, Bernie's the real deal. And with all due respect to Elizabeth Warren, I believe he's by far the one candidate the oligarchs and Trump fear the most. And therefore, in my opinion, I think Bernie, I'm sure he knows that what was true for FDR in 36 will be true for him when FDR said, quote, "Never before in all our history have these forces been so united against one candidate as they stand today," unquote.
It's in the 360, Sean. Let me give you a treat here, Jeff. Here you go.
Yeah.
"Never before in all our history have these forces been so united against one candidate as they stand today. They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred."
There you go. Back to you, Jeff.
That's great, Tom. Yeah, and I hope Bernie embraces that just as enthusiastically as FDR did. And having said that, you know, the answer to Robert Reich's question, can Bernie repeat his surprising success this time around, I say hell yeah, he can, and hell yeah, we can. And my question to you, the earlier caller who suggested Stacey Abrams as his running mate, that sounds good to me. And he wouldn't have to even wait till after the primaries if he wanted to do that, would he?
No. You know, I mean, he could announce a running mate anytime he wants. It's just, I don't think it's ever been done before the convention. What fascinated me was Nicholas, from Mexico, who called and pointed out that AMLO, the new president of Mexico, as part of his campaign strategy, announced who was going to be in his cabinet. And that shifted the conversation to who are all these cool people. And this isn't something to do before the primary, right? This is something to do after the primary when we have a Democratic candidate. And that Democratic candidate, and I think that's an absolutely brilliant strategy, that Democratic candidate then comes out and says, okay, you know, I'm going to, put Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez in charge of, you know, the fill in the blank, right? You could just go through the list of, you know, so you know what you're getting. I mean, if Donald Trump had said that he was going to have a cabinet made up of right-wing billionaires, I think a lot of people who voted for him wouldn't have voted for him because they believed he was going to raise taxes on billionaires and hurt his own class. And instead, what he did is he stocked the cabinet with billionaires and lobbyists.
Yeah, great point. And like Robert Reich said, it's the quintessential Trojan horse of the candidate.
Yeah.
Hey, and Tom, next time you talk to Nicholas, ask him to talk about the new female mayor of Mexico City. She's supposed to be a super progressive too.
Yes, I saw a clip of her on TV a couple of months ago that was just amazing. I'll do that, Jeff, or I'll try to remember. Jeff, thanks a lot. We'll be right back. It's 10 minutes before the hour. Welcome back, Miguel in Streamwood, Illinois. Hey, Miguel, thanks for listening to Chicago's Progressive Talk. What's up?
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
Great. What's on your mind?
You know, I never understood why people would be against Medicare for All. Every time, you know, a Democrat, someone comes out and say, you know, we want Medicare for All. You see it on Twitter everywhere. You'll see all these people against it. And it always blew my mind, like, how could people be against it? Right, especially lower class, middle class people. I can understand how a millionaire billionaire would be against it, but middle class, lower class people are against it. And I think I finally understood why.
Okay.
The other day I was listening to the radio and I came across a right wing hate radio station.
Mm-hmm.
And they were talking about this topic, and what they were saying to their people, the people that listen to those radio shows, they were saying that when Democrats say they want Medicare for All, what they're really saying is that they want to destroy Medicare. Meaning that when someone like a Democrat will say, you know, we want Medicare for all, they're saying that if we did that, that would literally destroy Medicare, and they will not have Medicare anymore.
Yeah, yeah.
It's kind of like Medicare banned, kind of, you know, the same argument.
I know, and it's happens. It's just, it's a phony argument. I mean, you know, it's just a purely phony argument. And you know, they've been doing this, you know, for some time. It's like the Republicans who have been fighting against Medicare ever since Lyndon Johnson got it passed. Ronald Reagan back in the 60s when the conversation about Medicare was happening, recorded a 33 LP for the American Medical Association saying, someday we'll look back when men were free, you know, the road to socialism is paved with Medicare and all that kind of stuff. That party is now trying to, and they did it in the last election, they did it in the election before that, the last two elections, where Republicans will say, well, Democrats with Medicare for All want to destroy your Medicare if you're over 65. No, it'll strengthen it, right? Making it an entire nationwide policy will strengthen it. So spot on, Miguel. And, you know, thanks for calling that out. Melinda in Abiquiu, New Mexico. Am I saying that right, Melinda?
That's right. Abiquiu, New Mexico. Hey, Tom.
Hey, what's up?
I am so excited. I'll bet you can guess why. I've been on, ever since he announced, I've been watching everything, the comments that are coming in, you know, the clips from MSNBC, Morning Joe, you know.
Are you talking about Bernie's candidacy?
Yes, I'm
okay.
Sorry. I should have said that.
Sure.
And the candidates are just overwhelmingly happy, positive, yay, Bernie. And, of course, I feel the same way, and I really appreciate your, you know, professor, all the talk you do about the climate change. It is a climate crisis. We've gone from global warming to climate change, and we are actually in a climate crisis.
Yes.
And I feel there's so many different issues, but I feel for the sake of my children and grandchildren, and probably even us, right, we're already experiencing it, we need a fearless, uncompromising warrior that will be bold, that will not be dissuaded. And that the only person I can see fulfilling that role is Bernie. And as far as Bernie's position on people of color, you know, and I've already seen them, you know, he can't get the black vote and all that. If you watch, there's a movie on YouTube called Burn the Movie. It's about 20 minutes long. Mm. And when he was 21 years old, he was out demonstrating against segregation, getting arrested.
He got arrested, chained to a black woman. I mean, I call them concerned trolls, and that's what I should have said to the guy who was calling, going, "Oh well, what about Bernie and black people?" Yeah, you know,
they do it on corporate TV too.
Yeah, yeah, it's you like, know, we're so concerned, you know. Yeah, I'm not.
I know. It's like, yeah. Did you know? I mean, this Bernie stands up for fairness and justice for everyone. He's uncompromising. He's been a voice in the wilderness for decades. He never. I mean, you can watch him on that Burn the Movie on YouTube, and you know he's sitting there in 1987, sounding like Bernie. You know,
yeah.
He's just always done. And what he accomplished in Vermont when he was the mayor there and when he, you know, took office there. I mean, Bernie is just, I think Bernie will keep working for us until the day he passes over, whether he's president, senator, whatever. And I just, I don't know, Bernie makes me cry. I don't know why. He has that effect on people. Why do you think that is?
I think it's nice to know that someone's genuine, Melinda, that they haven't gone through a conversion just in time to run for president. They're actually genuinely believe what they're saying. Melinda, I got to run, but thank you for the call. And thank you for being with us today. Another great day. We'll see how all this nonsense with Trump, it's not nonsense, these you know, criminal conspiracies shake out. And in the meantime, don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. It requires you. Do something. Get out there. Get active. Tag. You're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit TomHartman.com.